ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
duration along with
particular body before being promoted or evolved to another body. Killing an animal or any other living being simply places an impediment in the way of his completing his term of imprisonment in a certain body. One must therefore not kill bodies for one's sense gratification, but this will implicate one in sinful activity. Jadavara escaped the, well, was rescued by Kali herself from being killed by the dacoits. And now we see somehow or other he ended up walking around the road, and then the King Rahubana's men found him, and they needed someone to carry the king's palanquin, so they forced him to carry it. And as explained in these verses, he was very strong, young, and that's unsuitable. But because he was an exalted devotee, and of course he was born in a Brahmin family, he shouldn't have been doing this menial service of serving the king by carrying his palanquin. Nevertheless, he was doing that, and he did not do it properly, not because he wasn't strong, but because he was looking to see that he did not step on any ants. So this was his quality of non-violence, as Srila Prabhupada was mentioning in the purport. We see another case of that in the case of Mrigari the hunter. So Mrigari the hunter, the beginning one was just the opposite. He liked to kill things. He liked to kill the animals. Or he liked to half kill the animals and watch them die. So he was a very cruel person. And Narada Muni was horrified when he saw these half-dead animals with arrows in them who had not been really killed. So he wondered, who was doing this? They're half-killing the animal and they don't bother to kill the animal at all. So he was very disturbed by this. And then he saw this regarding the hunter there. And then he asked him, did you do this? And Mrigari the hunter said, yes, I'm a hunter, this is my livelihood, etc. But Narada Muni chastised him. And the favorable point of the hunter was, he offered respect to Narada Muni when he saw him. He got a great person, somehow or other. And that was his act of invoke the mercy of Narada Muni. So Narada Muni started to instruct him, just as we see here, Jatvara begins to instruct King Rugana. Both were unqualified in a sense, but Narada Muni instructed him, and he said, you have to keep, give up this occupation completely, and you just sit down and chant the holy name with your wife. Don't worry about your maintenance. So, Mrigari the hunter, he followed the words of Narada Muni, surprisingly. He had faith in the words of Narada Muni, he followed those words. And when Narada Muni returned 2 months later, the hunter was very, very excited to see him, and he was bowing down on the pathway. But when he was on the pathway and he saw the ants, and he would rush away to the ants before he offered his obeisances. And so Prabhupada was very, very surprised at how this person in 3 months has changed completely. First he was killing animals, not just ants, he was killing, how do you know, animals, and half killing them and watching them die. Now he is compassionate even to the ants, and he's brushing them aside so he doesn't kill them or harm them in any way. This is very surprising. And Narada Muni is not so surprising because this is the power of the holy name. Of course, it was also the power of Narada Muni because in 3 months generally you don't develop to that high level. But he had developed like that. So, brushing away ants is not the ultimate quality of Bhava Prema. It's a secondary aspect. But from that, we can also understand that the person must be quite advanced. So the real characteristic is surrender to the Lord. That's the main characteristic of the devotee. But then he has all these qualities which are like ornaments that manifest in him. So this compassion for all the entities is one of those particular qualities. And of course we say manifest at that stage. But even before then, it should manifest to some degree. And in fact, we have our own principles, four regular principles. When you start bhakti seriously, then you have to stop killing animals and stop eating meat, etc. So we put that principle of non-violence into the very beginning of bhakti. Of course, at the very beginning, they may not be doing this because they may be, you know, just not so serious and eating meat or committing violence, and they can still chant the whole name. But anyone who's serious has to do that. So, a serious practitioner of bhakti must give respect to all the living entities. And this is exemplified, as I mentioned the other day, in the nectar devotion, the preliminaries to bhakti 10, 20. Angas of bhakti, which are the preliminaries of the door to bhakti, so that you can chant or worship the deity. One of those is you respect the living entities, like the trees, the asvata, the cow, whatever, the brahmana, etc. Not the vaishnavas, but all living entities. And then another later on, the negative qualities, do not disturb any prani, any living entity, or this plant or animal, don't disturb them unnecessarily. So there's another rule. And these are preliminary to actually chanting and hearing and all these other processes. Okay. So from that we see this a very preliminary activity is compassion for all of the entities. If we examine closer, we will see that if we have faith, then we understand our position in relation to the Supreme Lord, and that is, we are eternally Krishna Dasa. But that doesn't mean only us. That is all the beginnings of Krishna Dasa. So not this final one who is serving Krishna. So we don't isolate ourselves when we think of ourselves as being the servant of the Lord. We see all the beginnings as service of the Supreme Lord. And if we don't, then we cannot practice bhakti properly. So I'm a servant of the Lord, nobody else is a servant, because that will be with other people. Doesn't work. So this idea that the service of the Lord is not just me, it's everybody, and that is part of the attitude we have in performing devotional service. So for ourselves, we engage in devotional service. Other living entities may not engage in devotional service. They may not be qualified. They may be plants or animals or whatever. And as human beings, we don't preach to the faith of those people, so we can't really engage them directly. But nevertheless, the devotee is compassionate to all these living entities, and somehow our compassion is manifested in preaching, somehow or other, either directly to those who have faith, or indirectly for those who don't have faith. So the way we preach to the faithless people is that we expose them to the holy name, let them hear it, at least. So that's what we go up here down in the street, let them hear it. They want to participate, at least they hear, and that's good for them. So that's how we preach to the people who may be hostile or neutral or whatever. Let them hear it. So that's the way of distributing this to the enemies. And it's not just the human beings that benefit. Haridas Thakur used to loudly chant. People would sometimes criticize the smartphones and other people, the Brahmins and other ones, making so much noise all the time. I can just sit and meditate like a yogi or something. So he's screaming in the middle of the night and chanting. What is the point of that? One, of course, is that the devotee is very enthusiastic and glorified the Lord, so he wants to do that as loud as possible. But the other thing, of course, is so it's good for himself and it's pleasing to Krishna. Other is that other living entities get benefits. Animals and plants. In other words, they get a gap of sympathy from that, even though they're not human beings. And they don't have any qualification in one sense. Simply by that vibration of the holy name, they do get some benefit. This is a type of preaching also. We preach to man, also class, whatever, when we chant all the way. This is also a form of compassion to all living entities. So that's why the holy name, Dhamma Sankirtan, is so powerful, because we get the effect because we get to hear and remember and chant together. It's very, very good. It's a good kind of devotional service, but everyone hears. The human beings, plus the animals, plus the plants. They all get the animals. And that's pleasing to Krishna also. Very, very powerful process. So that's a way in which the devotees show their compassion for all living entities, by letting all the other beings hear the name of the Lord. So that is things that constitutional to the process of bhakti itself, that this idea of compassion and mercy, respecting all living entities, is there. And therefore, in the third verse of Shashashita, there it says that we respect all living entities, manadaha. We give respect. And it's not just to Vaishnavas, it's to all living entities we give respect. Just as the tree is tolerant of all conditions, and whatever, and the grass is tolerant of being stepped on, whatever. So the devotee of the Lord gives respect to all living entities, whoever they are. And therefore, not just killing, but disturbing in any way is not considered proper. Unfortunately, just to live and maintain your body, you have to disturb somebody in the material world. So even if you're vegetarian, then you have to go to eat plants. Okay? So it's a minimizing disturbance, but nevertheless, there's still some disturbance. So it's not ideal. So you can be vegetarian and vegan and whatever, still it's not ideal. Because you're still, what about the plants? You're going to eat the plants, if not the animals or the cow or whatever. So the plants you can really buy us. So the very nature of life is that it's a little disturbance to other creatures. As Bhagavad says, the one jiva is food for another jiva. So that's how we survive in the material world, the body. And as long as we don't have it, as long as we have a body, we can use that for advancing spiritual life, or we can use it for sense gratification. If we use it for sense gratification, then all of our activities will be disturbed, other than we just call sin. And everything is a sin. So even the plants that you see are sin, even the animals, and we get back and killing and lying, all this is sin because it's disturbing other living entities. Sin of exploiting the earth is a, and exploiting the natural resources is all sinful. If we're not religious. So, as I said, it's very difficult to survive in this world at all and be non-violent, because it's by our nature of living that we have to interact with the world and disturb it. So, as the scriptures always say that, okay, yes, you can to some degree, you can harm the living entities to the extent we have to live. So then there's permissible limits. So we don't have to stop eating, but we eat with minimum of violence. And so at the top that is, no more meat at all. And at the bottom it is, you eat the meat, but you eat in a restricted way. So therefore, there is sacrifice of the goat to Kali. Okay, you want to eat that meat. But you can't eat all meat. You just you have to go through this whole process of offering the Kali. Then you can sacrificial meat or whatever. Somehow, there's some restriction there. And as we go higher in the through the gunas and through the varnas, and then we get to the brahmana, then the brahmana should not eat the meat at all. And similarly, should not eat all these other things like intoxicants or whatever. So the violence gets minimized as we go higher and higher as a human being, we get to suck the one. And so the person of Sattva-gun controls the senses more, and then he has more rules for restrictions, because he can follow those restrictions nicely. Right? So this minimizes the violence, doesn't remove the violence. The Brahman has to eat rice or whatever he has to eat, but it's minimal. So that is permissible, to some degree. And then another thing is that if you're going to eat the food, then you offer it to the Lord, then it's completely free of sin. Not just minimized, it's free of sin. And not only that, it destroys sin. So bhakti destroys sin, yeah? It takes your meat. It destroys suffering, karma, everything. And so by taking prasadam, we destroy sin. And we don't create, we don't minimize, but rather we destroy sin. So that's the advantage of taking prasadam. Similarly, even though there's other ways in which we interact with the world, like walking on the ground and you step on an ant, also going down the street or work, driving a car or whatever, squishing the insects or whatever, because the devotees engage in devotional service, then, again, exemption. And Krishna says, aham param sarva papabhyo mukhyasyami, I free you from all sins. So normally, in the Varnashram system, they say, oh, well, look, we're killing these animals, we're stepping on them, we light a fire, we kill a bug, we drink some water, we're killing an animal, or germ, or whatever like that. So what do we do? So then they do Pancha Mahayagyas every day to get prayaschitta for their atonement, for their little accidental sins every day. But the devotee doesn't have to do that, because the atonement is bhakti itself. So that atones for everything. It's the highest atonement. So just by doing devotional service, and that takes care of all of the little sins that we are not even conscious of doing all day long. And then for the other sins, of course, then we follow as much as possible all of these rules, like the Varnashram system, don't lie, don't cheat, etc. Welcome guests in your house with charity words, etc. So these are the other things in Kamakanda. Varnashram, too, regulate us and help us control our sinful propensities, and encourages the opposite, that is, charity, which is an aspect of compassion. But then when it comes to the devotee, then what is compassion? We're less interested in the compassion of charities of serving the body. Rather, we want to do something devotional. So then we do preaching work or serve prasadam. And this is something which is spiritual. So in this world, it is impossible to be completely compassionate and non-violent, but we minimize it, and then we transform it through the process of bhakti yoga. And then we're free from all of this contamination in the material world. If we give up the body and we go to the spiritual world, then we're free. No more dependence on the material body, no dependence on food, no. So there's no concept of having to depend on, you know, killing or harming other living entities in order to survive. The spiritual world, the spiritual body, it doesn't depend on food. Yeah. It just simply depends on Krishna prema. So it's a completely different. So as long as the material, yes, we have this problem. As the devotee advances, then he's less attracted to the material world. That's completely, you know, not the body, he's convinced of that. So he's not interested in sense gratification, etc. And so when he gets to bhava and prema, then he's really minimized his needs. And we see that in the case of the Goswamis, where they're simply sitting in Vrindavan with very simple clothing, sitting under a tree, taking minimum of food, etc. like that. Not because they're trying to show off austerity, but simply because they're so absorbed in the Lord that they don't want to bother with the material body at all. So in that case, their interaction with material energy is minimized, so it's not completely destroyed. Minimized. And behind that, we see with the Uttam Arikari, one who is fixed in prema, not only is he not inimical to any living entity, rather the opposite, he sees that everybody has prema. And he sees everything in terms of prema. So even for the asuras and the demons and whatever, he sees them as being full of prema for the Lord. So his vision is one that everything in the material world is cooperating with the Supreme Lord in the highest level of prema. So there's no concept of hostility towards any living entity at all. Naturally, they're all devotees of the Lord. So that's a very high stage. So when we're on the lower level, sadhana, we cannot imitate those activities of the person in prema. But nevertheless, as I said, we do have them. From the very beginning, we do have to have this idea of non-violence and compassion for all living entities, giving respect to all living entities from the very beginning of bhakti. If we don't have it, then the bhakti is not real bhakti. And so it is a part of bhakti. But on the other hand, we shouldn't think that's everything and it's independent of bhakti. Then it becomes material charity, material compassion. So we balance up the whole idea. So Chatvara was very advanced, and consequently he showed all the qualities, secondary qualities that a devotee is expected to manifest. And one of these was this not trying to interfere with any living entities, so he wouldn't step on the ants at all. And this took precedence over his duty to the king of caring about the nice way. You know, just thinking, oh, I'm going to be compassionate to it. Of course, he accepted the burden of carrying. And of course, he was forced to do it, but he didn't mind that also, just as he didn't mind being captured by the dacoits and the sacrifice of God, he didn't protest it. So he didn't protest when the government started having carrying the palanquin. But he was thinking of the ants when he was doing his work, so therefore he couldn't really do that work very properly. And thus, the king complained. And then this committed some apparata as far as the king complaining and criticizing Jadvara. But as we see, again, Jadvara showed a remarkable quality. Generally, if people commit apparatas, then they have no chance of progressing. And if they commit apparata against the devotee usually is not going to be very merciful to them. I think it may be indifferent to them. But here we see that Jadvara was very merciful to King Arugana, though King Arugana was an offender. And he began to give him teachings. When he gave no one teachings in his life before that, he never spoke to anyone, and no one had a clue that he had any spiritual inclination or realization. But then, when he did speak, he came from the very highest platform. And you can understand that he was very, very elevated. And therefore, in this, that's not complete there. Anyway, the last word is Mahanubhava. That's a greatly realized soul, great soul. And then we see later on when he begins to speak that his words are very, very powerful. And though they were exalted words and powerful words, they also had an effect on the king. The king began to understand that he was a fool. He began to respect Janamara as a great soul. So not only did he preach, but he preached in such a way that he could affect the mind and the heart of this king. We see in even in Sadhana Bhakti, we have an Uttamadhikari in faith, and that is such a person who has thorough knowledge of the scripture and understand it very logically and has very, very deep faith. And so when he speaks it, he can convince people. But that's on a lower level. On the level of Jadvara, we don't have to think yet study all the scriptures like that, because it basically was completely rejecting everything, didn't want to study, didn't want to be a Brahmin, didn't take any instruction from his father. But he had the knowledge, he had the realization on a very high level, and therefore he could speak very effectively and convincingly and penetrate the heart of King Rudra and have him give up his faults and you become very respectful to Jadavarna. Okay, any question there?
The soldiers unhesitated
Yes.
So, didn't they learn from the light, from Jayaprakash's body, that he was a great devotee?
Oh, because they asked him to carry it? They didn't. Well, the people who were looking for a person to carry the palanquin were looking for someone very nice and strong, because that's basically the quality. They weren't looking for a devotee. And Jat Bharat, though he was a great devotee, was somewhat covered. As we see previously, the dacoits also said, oh, there's a man animal. Okay, someone like a real low person, because he can't speak, he can't do anything, so we'll sacrifice him. So they didn't recognize that he was on frame level either. So similarly, these persons here, the people who carry palanquin, they got him, but then they couldn't realize his great nature, so that's why they engaged in that way. People who are covered over with material and cannot recognize a great devotee, even if the devotee's not hiding. In this case, Jadvar was also hiding. He didn't want anybody to know who he was, because he didn't want to get disturbed. But then, of course, when he was about to be sacrificed in Kali, then, of course, he did manifest some avulsion, so he broke the Kali Murti open when she came up like that. So, you know, so it's an involuntary loss, but nevertheless, generally he hid his qualities so that normal people couldn't understand who he was, as Sukadeva Goswami also did.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Maharaj, you mentioned that the spiritual body is maintained by prema. Two questions. Reference. And you can assume the body part is maintained by prema.
So what's obviously if we have a spiritual body in the spiritual world, we get nothing to do with the material world. So therefore in the material world we eat in order to maintain the body. We don't eat and we die, whatever. Spiritual world, like even in Upanishads, they say there's no hunger, no thirst, etc. So we're not dependent upon the material organs or anything and that too. Maintain ourselves in the spiritual world. Nevertheless, why do we get a body in the spiritual world at all? If you go to Brahman, there is no spiritual body. You're just kind of immersed in Brahman and it's all formless. So the formation of that spiritual body in itself is the result of bhakti. And if you do bhakti, gradually that form begins to manifest. And of course, it manifests nicely in prema, because we want to serve the Lord. Yeah? So because of our prema, then we say the body results. Yeah? Another way of looking at it is that when you get to bhava stage, there the definition given by Rupa Goswami is Visuddha Sakta Vishesha. He says it's what manifests in bhava stage. And then commentary in Jiva Goswami and Vishwanatha is that Suda Sattva Vishesha means Sandini and Padini Shakti of the Lord. They manifest the Jiva at that point, and this produces this bhava and prema. And along with that, what happens is you get the spiritual body. How can you experience prema and how can you serve Krishna unless you've got a body? So that you need some eyes to see Krishna. You need some hands and feet to serve Krishna. So then a body develops, you say, through the Sandini Shakti. In the spiritual world, the body manifests, and the qualities in that body manifest. And through the Sambit, we get our awareness in using our senses when we look at Krishna with that sense, we can see him. And then probably any manifestation you see Krishna, then you start experiencing bliss because you understand the beauty of his form. So all these things manifest as you go through bhava and prema. So the spiritual body and the spiritual world is therefore dependent upon the manifestation of prema, and then consequently being involved in the different shaktis there to manifest that body. Now, they do eat in the spiritual world. See Krishna going out and he's eating. In fact, every morning, he eats Madhya Soda and Rohini, the nice breakfast of Krishna, and go of God. Then when he's in the fields, he's eating his mother's passing lunch and eats the curd rice and things like this. And when he comes in the evening, then it's a big meal again in the house, and the Maharaj is there, everybody eats together. So he is eating. But this is again an interaction of prema, and it increases the prema. Mother Yasoda cooks, and that's her anubhava, her expression of her love. And then she feeds Krishna, and then Krishna eats because Mother Yasoda's food, so therefore he's out of great love for Mother Yasoda, he eats all the food and everything. So when he's eating, actually, it's not like the material food, the nourishment is the prema. This is when Krishna takes Mother Yasoda's milk, it's prema. It's not like material milk. So he's nourished by Mother Yasoda's prema. And then Krishna's love increases because of affection of Mother Yasoda, what she does and how she feeds him.
When an animal dies or a living entity dies untimely, is it predestined or is it coming in the way of its duration?
Well, generally we take it as it's not predestined, it's something that when we interfere with it, then it definitely is. Also, that karma, that will have to kill him. You can't say that. So in that sense, no, we can't take advantage of the law of karma as to justify any act of violence we do because of the entities of the karma suffer, therefore all kill them or hit them or whatever. And the same for human beings, we can't say the same thing. Of course, the animals themselves do suffer karma because they're given a certain body because of previous karmas. But those karmas were earned as a human being. So they're wearing off the karmas and not producing karmas at all. And the karmas they get are those particular bodies. But when they're in that body, they cannot accrue karmas in any way. So there's of course a little balance here in lives of human beings. We just say another person harms another living entity, another human being as well as a karma that I hate him, so therefore he's a suffering in that sense. But the human beings' interaction with each other is very complex, and we can't just simply attribute other people's suffering to karma. It's also due to our immediate actions that we get these results. Also, we can't explain karma for everything. So as far as human beings are concerned, at least it's not like that. But there is an element of free will there, and if we use our free will the wrong way, then we get very serious results. We can't say, oh, it's just karma for the animal, or the human being.
I just want some clarification on this. So, we understand that in Bhakti Yoga, in our day-to-day life, we accidentally kill many living entities, whether it's walking or even breathing.
Yeah.
But in Bhakti Yoga, the reaction gets taken away. So, why did Jagar not put so much emphasis on what's taken on hands? This is a very real-life personality. You would know that even if he stepped on hands, he's in the Krishna consciousness and the reaction.
Yeah. Well, that's so, we commit these accidental things, fine, we don't get any reaction, but as much as possible, if we're conscious of it, then we avoid. So if we know that, oh, there's an ant there, oh, it doesn't matter, I'll step on it because I'm in a hurry then. But rather you say, oh, no, you try to avoid as much as possible. But even though if we do somehow or other harm them, then we're exempted, but as much as possible, we avoid. So similarly, like in Isha Upanishad, it says there that you have your quota, and you take your quota, but not more than your quota. So therefore, we don't take advantage of our position as a human being and do excessive sense gratification, even though it's possible. And then say, well, I'm exempted because of the devotee. So we try to restrict ourselves also, so we don't eat too much. We don't do things in excess. Restrict as much as possible.
But this was getting in the way of his duty, because his duty was very keen, but he was not doing it properly.
Oh, well, yes. I guess he wasn't doing his duty properly, but for him, the duty to the king was less important than his spontaneous bhakti and his idea that we shouldn't hurt living entities. That's why. Of course, he said, well, he disturbed the king. So he's disturbing someone else there, but he was as opposite to the king of the ants, and we saw them all.
These two things go together.
not wanting respect is very essential. We see even at the end of the last few slokas, then he says, above all, beware of Krishna. This desire for position and respect. You have to give respect to others. This is a very great enemy of devotional service. And of course, we look in when Bhaktivinoda Thakur analyzes the anarthas consisting of Hridayagarbhya, which means weakness of heart there. Then Pratishtha is one of those also, among Kutinati and Masarya. Kutinati is a duplicity, and Pratishtha is desire for position. It's a contaminated to the heart, the weakness of the heart. So this is an anartha. These are unfavorable, we can say. And then the opposite, of course, is we give respect to all the humanities. So if we desire respect, then it's very difficult to give respect. I think we're doing the opposite. We're trying to get all the respect for ourselves, so how we can respect all of the humanities. So the devotee's opposite, he thinks he's a servant, the servant, the servant, the leader to die. So therefore, he takes everyone who's on his in a higher position. So therefore, he's naturally humble as a part of bhakti itself.
So we heard in the yesterday lecture about Jeevdaya and Namuruji. And we also heard today that when I talk to the devotee, he speaks, then it touches the heart of the common people. And we also see that in our life that that we think that doing preaching activity that seems like we can convince ourselves, okay, if I'm doing that, that's good enough. I'm doing the best, I'm doing right, So sometimes we see others, they are more, they look very passionate in that activity. But, so the question is that preaching kind of mood, how it should be in a balanced state?
Well, different people probably have different personalities, so the preaching may take different forms also. Okay? So some people run out and just keep them all day long in the street jumping up and down. That's their way of doing it. Other people may explain things very Shastrically to people or in a way that they can appreciate whatever. Others may take a more indirect approach and go gradually, whatever. So of course it really depends on the individual. Some may just read books, whatever. So it's up to the individual which mode he wants to preach in. In any case, we're trying to see the words that do follow Jeevas, and we do have to act in such a way that to make them favorable somehow or other, that's all. And of course, there's no ways of doing that. And of course, it's also different for different people, how everyone responds, so we have to choose the proper way to preach to different experiences.